to another as functional, that is less aggressive.
Great.
The feng shui antenna?
Yeah.
We've been looking at these nets that people do fishing with all around the water, and they seem like they're maybe they could be one way to address that problem. They're very beautiful nets. Have you seen them? They're almost like hanging baskets. Mm. What about a hammock? You know, a hammock.
To get your mega dose.
Yeah, right. For that. Yeah, you want to take a nap in it. Yes.
Or something you could swallow to get it from the inside. Like really, really getting it.
I was thinking about this drawing that was in the window that a kid had made about there was a kid that made a picture of an antenna, right?
But I think it was Kate's daughter.
Oh.
Well, there were two. Were you talking about the one with the eye?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And can you maybe explain how it looked? Kind of.
It looked a little bit like the stem of a plant. The whole thing was maybe the size of a tall sunflower. I seem to remember a couple of leaves close to the bottom of the stem, and then further up there were maybe spirals, vague love hearts, and then this big eye. And so, yeah, somebody did a copy in chalk on the window of a drawing that was made in Greece by the daughter of one of our collective members.
And that picture just made me think about like how wonderful it would be to make an antenna with like different kind of like maybe a plant in an like in real life, like how if you like put different elements together, like what kind of signal will you get if you like paired stuff?
Yeah.
And it was just an abstract thought, so it's not like, I don't even
know. No, it's amazing. I think there's a very poignant project by a radio artist who you know from Berlin, Iona. I'm not saying her name right.
Joanna. Vrema Moser.
Yeah, who has done these. She's put some kind of a coil around trees so that we can making audible what trees are already receiving of all the signals that we are sending into. You know, like, so you just, it's almost like a form of pollution that the trees have to receive because they are like antennas. So I think, and then it makes it audible for us. So it's, you know, we see what impact we're making too for all these other, for all these natural antennas out there.
What was the person's name again?
Joanna Vrema Moser.
Okay, nice. I will check that out.
Yeah, she does really great work and workshops too.
Talking about workshops, if somebody is listening here and is curious about maybe building an antenna or a radio, they can come to Shortwave Collective's laboratory, living lab. And how do you find that if you are in Struer?
Well, you come to where the lake is transmitting from. And they'll tell you where we are. Basically, you walk down the stairs, and then we're under the bridge. We're part of, like, basically in a room that's under the train tracks.
And it's like one archway further along than the info center for the festival.
So maybe go to the info center, and they will
walk you by hand. Then you'll actually be at Shortwave Collective. That keeps happening.
Oh, yeah. I've done that.
Yeah.
Kate and Karen and Maria.
Meira.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you so much for visiting here in our caravan, talking about antennas. I'm afraid I have to say that we don't have an antenna here, like a physical antenna, because we are sending on speakers and on the internet. But
internet uses antennas.
There you go.
And aren't we using all of our different antennas too?
Yeah. That's true.
Including our eyes.
Do you want to say something
I did want to say one thing for those people who are around in Struer, that this evening we're going out to listen to open wave receivers and some of the other things that we've been building and working on this week. And the meeting place is our lab, which is under the archway, very close to the info center, at 7:45 in the evening.
7:45 in the evening.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Bye, thank you.
Bye, Mayra. Till later.
Listening to the Lake Radio.
Og mens Shortwave Collective, Karen Werner og Kate Donovan er på vej ud af vores lille campingvogn her, kommer Louise tilbage på stolen, fordi at vi må have lavet det her lille intermistiske setup, hvor at Louise stod ude foran campingvognen, og Kate og Karen sad inde i campingvognen sammen med mig, fordi at vi kun har tre stole indenfor. Det vil sige fire, fordi at Rasmus skal også have en, som er tekniker. Og nu er Louise igen tilbage på stolen.
Det er.
Louise, vi sender jo stadigvæk her fra Store Tracks på anden dagen. Hvis du lige er tunet ind, så det du lyttede til, var altså en samtale med kollektivet Shortwave Collective, som er en af kunstnergrupperne, som deltager i årets lydbiennale her i Struer.
Og jeg vil også lige i forlængelse af det give en kæmpe anbefaling til at gå ned og tage et kig og måske deltage i deres workshop, som er åben. Og altså, man kan, jeg har set folk, der har fundet østers, og træplader eller ting, man lige har fundet rundt omkring. Og det kan man tage med derned, og så kan man simpelthen bygge sådan en lille sender, der kan fange de her usynlige elektromagnetiske felter, hvor der er lyd i omkring os.
Og hvem kunne ikke tænke sig sådan en?
Jeg vil i hvert fald helt sikkert have en.
Man kan jo prøve at se, om den kan fange The Lake Radio også. Men lover ikke noget, men det kan også være, at den fanger noget andet. Louise her, om ikke så lang tid, så kommer der en særudgave af det program, som hedder Chest, her på kanalen. Det er her klokken 4. Så kommer der et lille værtskifte igen. Det er LM Skovhøj, som i dag sender det. Kunne du have lyst til, at vi hørte et lille stykke musik inden?
Det synes jeg kunne være rigtig dejligt. Lad os gøre det.
Så tror jeg, vi skal høre Carmen Villange med et nummer, der hedder Only Love From Now On.
Jeg står her på torvet i Struer til lydfestivalen Struer Tracks 4, hvor jeg også viser rundt. Mit navn er Lasse Højland Hansen, og du lytter til The Lake Radio.
Listening to the Lake Radio.
Det var virkelig, virkelig et dejligt nummer, William. Hvad var det, det hed?
Det kan jeg ikke huske. Men noget med Only Love, og så noget mere.
Jeg synes sådan, efter den her snak om antenner, at jeg bare sådan kan mærke, at mine antenner, de er lidt mere ude her.
Ja. Det kan sådan, du mærke, hvad de tager ind?
Jeg ved det ikke. Jeg kan bare mærke, at det er en rigtig fed måde at tænke på.
Ja.
Ja. Dem vil jeg lige tage med mig sådan her de næste par dage.
Jeg kan godt lide det her. Altså, det er jo en frase der, men man siger, at man har antennerne ude, ikke?
Mm.
Og det er jo meget konkret, det vi snakker om. Når vi snakker om, hvad vil det sige at have antenner, og være en antenne. Og når man siger det som en metafor, så har jeg tit følelsen af, at man mener noget andet.
Mm.
Men jeg tænker også, det er jo det, man mener. Det er, at man... Så mærker man noget med de antenner der,
ja.
Hvor end de nu sidder henne.
Og man mærker måske noget, man ikke rigtig forstår.
Mm.
Ja, skal vi lige have et sidste track her, inden vi byder Chest til mikrofonen?
Det synes jeg vil være en god idé. Så vi kan jo se, hvordan vi sådan, mens vi lytter til det nummer, kan vi virkelig prøve at få antennerne ud. Så se, hvordan, om man lytter på det på en anden måde.
Lad os prøve det. Her kommer The Vernon Spring med Unassigned 2. Say I'm all alone. Say I got nobody to hold me. Say I got a second thing coming in the mirror of my bones. 3 years old in the silence.
You're listening to Lake Radio at Struer Tracks, biennial for sound and listening. My name's Hannah, I'm from Shortwave Collective. Come find us in the Living Radio Lab.
Listening to the Lake Radio.
Det, som der sker nu, det er, at der er programskift her på kanalen. Og det foregår på den måde, at jeg tager et stik ud af det sted, hvorfra jeg spiller lyd. Og så giver jeg det til Ellen, som laver chest lige om lidt. Her kommer kablet, Ellen. Og det er ikke til langt kablet, så det skal lige, vi skal finde den bedst mulige vej, det kan komme fra A til B, som man siger. Og det, der så sker det nu, det er, at jeg kommer til at spille en jingle. Og når jeg har spillet den jingle, så er der altså et nyt program på. Og så er der bare tilbage at sige rigtig godt testprogram og rigtig god dag derude i Struer, eller hvor I ellers sidder og lytter.
Listening to the Lake Radio.
Thank you. Blind Hurricane. Bit of a Neil Young influence there, you might argue, and not just the word hurricane either.
Episode 4. The day began in the IRT with the clanging of Mr. Korbelev's huge copper gong, one of the few possessions of his that still remained in the house.
At 6:30, we sat down to eat breakfast in the airy, high-ceilinged dining room with its large windows giving onto the garden, and listened while one of the members read something suitable. Gorky, perhaps. A relief, as the food was best not dwelt on. It was usually kasha, buckwheat porridge, or perhaps blandinka, as we called millet porridge, with salt fish. Even in the summer, when supplies were relatively plentiful, there was already the sensation of dread before you'd started your bowl. The last spoonful was drawing near. You took smaller and smaller bites, and you savoured the feeling of food on your tongue, in your mouth. You never swallowed too quickly. The only way to overcome hunger was to welcome it in. After we'd scraped our bowls clean, if it was not a working day, we sat in the garden and debated how to run the commune. The men's dormitory was Mr. Korbeliev's bedroom, while at first the female members of the commune had the small separate bedrooms at the back of the house. Then Dr. Marina disagreed with this arrangement. A motion was carried unanimously, and the following week the three back bedrooms were knocked into one. Sonia, Dr. Marina, Vera and I moved in together. "The children seem to be turning everything upside down, Miss Gertie," Anna Vladimirovna kept saying querulously. "In my day, father would have sent them to bed with no supper." "Well, that's more or less what happens these days, too." "Nothing to worry about," Vera soothed them. Vera, who wasn't remotely interested in politics, was probably the most generous and selfless communard of all of us. She often helped me with the old ladies, who adored her. "Let's listen to the gramophone, shall we?" Dr. Marina and Vera had brought the gramophone with them, and in the evenings we danced on the lawn. Pasha asked his aunt to dance, and Nikita led out a shy and delighted mamzelle. I hung back as each song ended, hating myself for minding that he never asked me. Towards the end of 1917, Slavkin had begun work on his first psychotechnological device, the propaganda machine. This was no more than a rusty upside-down grain hopper from the back stables bolted onto the Korbeliev's open carriage. To enter, one mounted the steps of the carriage and squeezed through a door cut in the side of the hopper. The benches had been removed, and instead there was a single large chair, heavily padded, with a footstool, while the curving wall in front was entirely covered by a white screen. The patient seated himself in the chair and was strapped in around the waist, legs and arms. A sizable helmet was lowered to restrict his viewing solely to the screen. Then the door was closed and the anti-bourgeois vaccination began. A series of short films and flashing images, accompanied by a soundtrack, played on a gramophone lodged at the top of the funnel. Meanwhile, canisters of different, powerful smells were discharged into the hopper. The temperature was raised by means of several gas lamps, and at certain moments in the session, the whole construction could be violently and unexpectedly pushed and joggled from the outside. We hoped that the combination of these effects would produce an indelible impression on the brain. Night after night, we pooled our ideas and experimented with the propaganda machine settings, the right images, the snatches of speech, the timing, searching for the touch paper to light people's hearts. One hot Friday in late August, I walked from the school to the Hotel National at the bottom of Terskaya. I climbed the grand Art Nouveau stairs to the office of Emile Pilyagin, a party official who, so the director at the language school had told me, wanted private English lessons. My first sight of him was of a round, startlingly white bald patch surrounded by black brilliantined hair. He was peering closely at a file in the centre of his desk, while on either side of him stood a tower of other books and papers. "Ah, Comrade Freely, very good. If you wouldn't just mind waiting while I finish a small piece of business off." I sat in the corner of his office while he called in his secretary. "Bring me those papers, comrade." His secretary, a tall, serious girl, who looked somehow familiar, did as she was told. I waited for almost half an hour while Pilyagin worked through these papers. At last, he waved the secretary out of the room and stood up. He was barely any taller on his feet than sitting down. I stood and sat down again quickly, embarrassed by my extra foot of height. At the end of the lesson, he said, "I've heard about your institution. And Slavkin, is that his name?" He stood up to dismiss me. "Perhaps you'll tell me all about it in our next lesson." I hurried straight from the National to meet Pasha Adna Kompros, the Commissariat of Enlightenment, where he was working in the Department of Museums. Pasha and I had arranged to visit Smolensk Market together that evening. All day I had been aware of this task ahead of me, a knotch of apprehension in my stomach. The markets were periodically closed down by the Soviet in an attempt to control all the food distribution in the capital. But as most of Moscow's citizens received either a ration that would have killed them off within a couple of months or nothing at all, we were forced onto the black market. The traders swirled and eddied, regrouping in the suburbs and then creeping street by street back to the centre. Each time the Red Guards knocked them back more viciously. But even that didn't stop the traders. Pasha and I bought dried fish and rusks, millet and barley. And from a tall, well-built woman, even a couple of pounds of butter, half melted, so I bargained her down a little. "Take it, and good health to you," said the woman cheerfully. "I'll leave for home now, and you better hurry too. I've got a feeling those red bastards will be along soon." "Why's that?" She lowered her voice. "Old Crooked Legs over there's packing up and leaving, and he's..." She knocked her fist quietly on the palm of her other hand. I understood her. He was a stukach, an informer, who knock-knock-knocked on the police door. I felt it then, a ruffle, like a wind, from the other end of the market, shouting, "Comrades, beware!" I saw the guards pushing into the market, glints of their rifles, ripples of people panicking, crashing into each other, a child's screams. We ran across the bare expanse of the square. I heard my breath loud in my ears, shouts behind me, then bang! A rifle shot. My knees buckled. For a moment I thought I'd been hit. "Let's go, let's go," hissed Pasha in my ear. He hauled me up by the arm. "It's just a shock. You're all right." And we reached the side streets and dived into a courtyard, slid down the wall. Pasha was still holding me by the arm. "Oh, Gertie," he whispered after a moment, giving me a lopsided grin. "You are my one true love, even though you do fall over in the most inconvenient places." "Just stop, Pasha," I spat back at him, furious. I was shaking. I could hardly get my words out. "Why do you still have to talk like that? In the old days it was a joke that we all understood, but..."
"What?"
"Well, we're all trying to be honest now. Sincere." "Well, I suppose I must mean it then," he whispered, still smiling. "I love you, Miss Gertie, especially when you're telling me off. It's so easy to mock the governess, isn't it?" Tears of rage pricked my eyes. "All your revolutionary ideas, and at the heart, you're just a snob, like your aunt." In the early days of the IRT, many of our evenings were spent listening to and discussing each member's piece on their revolutionary development. As we drank the hot water flavoured with a little grated carrot that we called tea, Sonia read us her account, describing the failure of her marriage. In 1915, she had married Petya, only to wave him off to war just a few months later. In 1916, he was badly wounded and lost a leg to septicemia. Throughout 1917, while he was ill, she devoted herself completely to him. But as he recovered, all her attempts to be a good wife were met by increasing hostility on his part and frustration on hers. I thought the marriage would probably have foundered even without the injury, but of course that didn't stop Sonia from feeling that she'd failed him at his most vulnerable. "You did well," Nikita said. Sonia looked up at him, and I saw that she was crying.
"No," she retorted. "I did not. That's what I mean. Now, I must work hard and do well. All my life I've wasted time, squandered my privileges, but now..."
"Now you have changed. Forgive yourself." Pasha's account of his revolutionary development was really the story of his love affair with the avant-garde. I couldn't quite believe in Pasha's commitment to the revolution. His dandyism seemed to undermine it, above all his constant ironic commentary on life. Yet he was entirely serious about art and the theatre. He insisted on dragging us to the theatre several times a week. The futurist reviews always ended in commotion. I remember one evening at the Café Petariesk on Kunietsky Bridge. Sklavkin's lecture on the prop mash was followed by an act in which all the performers wore machine costumes made out of cardboard, 8 or 9 foot tall. They looked imposing, but their voices were inaudible. After a while, tired of listening to muffled and incomprehensible fragments of poetry, the audience began to shout and throw things at the tiny stage. The futurists threw off their cardboard tubes and a brawl ensued. Through the crowd, I suddenly caught sight of Emil Pilyagin. He looked out of place and panicky. I pushed my way through to him. "Comrade Pilyagin, what brings you here?" We had talked about the event, I remembered. Pilyagin was having 3 hours of lessons a week. I had become quite fond of him. He turned and smiled and immediately solemnized his face. "Comrade Freely," he said with a bow. "Well, as a government official, I try to keep myself abreast of developments in culture." I felt myself blushing ridiculously. "Well, it's very kind of you to come. Would you like to meet Slavkin, now you're here?"
"Certainly."
I forced my way over to Slavkin, but Pilyagin was stuck behind a group of boys who were rather the worse for alcohol. "Oh, Nikita, my pupil wants to meet you. Go and rescue him, won't you?" I gasped. Slavkin, a foot taller than anyone else, passed through the crowd with ease, occasionally lifting tussling boys out of the way. With an amiable smile, he arrived at Pilyagin's side. Slavkin put a hand on his shoulder to guide him through the melee. Pilyagin shook his hand off, a mulish look on his face. Then Slavkin took Pilyagin forcibly by the shoulders and propelled him across the room to me. I'm not sure his legs weren't lifted off the ground. Before I could say anything, Slavkin bundled Pilyagin out through the fire escape. I squeezed after them. Out on Terskaya Street, Pilyagin shook Slavkin off and brushed down his jacket. "Please forgive me, comrade, if I was mistaken," said Slavkin gravely. "Gertie asked me to come and help you. These days the kids do sometimes get carried away." Pilyagin cleared his throat. "There was no need to manhandle me." In the years since, I have probably wasted not just hours, but whole days wondering about this episode. And even so, I still can't work out if it had any bearing on the course of events.
It was sticking its tongue out at me.
high, high. I'm sitting in the siblings' room, up very high, with this skylight window. And there are pigeons on the roof next door. And maybe sometimes you will hear the gulls overhead. There has been, after all, many days of rain. And the sun is now coming through the local clouds. So here's to this. Welcome to you and to the sun. You look at the sun, then you return home and you can't work. You're impregnate with all that light.